We are looking at preterism, and just taking a look at the what they say about preterism. Preterism is the view that descriptions in Revelation. Did we read this before? Yeah, we did read that before. Okay, we read that before. Full and radical, or versus partial and moderate, or moderate preterism. There are a lot more partial or moderate preterists than there are full preterists, because full preterism just seems to be so untenable. It just seems like it's really grasping at straws in some very unrealistic ways. But beyond that, and we'll see that, is that it provides the worst view of history and what's happening from here on out of any possible view. And we'll see that in just a minute. So moderate preterism. Moderate preterism, though it sees the coming of Christ predicted in the Olivet Discourse as having been already fulfilled, it still believes in a future consummation of Christ and His kingdom based on other New Testament texts. Radical preterism, on the other hand, sees virtually the entire New Testament eschatology as having been realized already. Now, that is written by R.C. Sproul, who is a Reformed Covenant theologian and a partial preterist. So he is writing that. He's making that comment about full or radical preterism. So when we get to just briefly looking at full preterism, or radical preterism, and that, you know, everybody uses these prefixes or these adjectives that are inflammatory to describe the other person's position. So we talk about, you know, we're dispensationalists, but then we have to watch out for ultra-dispensationalists and hyper-dispensationalists, and so they do the same thing. The moderate preterists say that the other group are the radical preterists, so I guess it depends on where you're standing. But full preterism would teach, if we believe Jesus and Paul, we must believe that the first century Christians experienced everything they were promised. The reason they say that, and we'll be looking at this verse specifically, and it's in it's Matthew 24:34 concerning this generation. This generation will not pass away. And so that is the, if there is a single crux verse, that is it. And if you can deal with that verse appropriately, then there's no reason to hold to either full or partial preterism. It knocks the crutches out from under it as not only being a possible view, but actually a tenable view. So we'll be looking at that. Now, to give you an idea why I said what I did about full preterism, going on with what you have in your notes, the quote, some preterists maintain that there was no literal rapture. This is being written by a full preterist, okay? Did you catch that? So this is being written by a full preterist. So some preterists maintain there was a no literal rapture. So if that's being written by a full preterist, that means he believes that there was a literal rapture in 70 AD. And he goes on to, it's not exactly mocking, but maybe a little bit. He said, all this simply cloud imagery commonly associated with visitations, visions from God in the Old Testament. So he's putting down somewhat the partial preterist view of saying, well, you know, this really didn't happen. It was kind of in the clouds and spiritual. But we full preterists believe that Paul meant what he said and Jesus meant what he said, and putting the two together, of course there was a literal rapture. Well, we would agree with the fact of a literal rapture, obviously, but we would disagree with the timing. They would say that, again, Matthew 24 requires a 70 AD rapture, and we'll look at that again. So they claim that the living Christians simply lived out their normal lives. So again, he's talking about the partial preterists. So they say that living Christians simply lived out their normal lifespans. In other words, they didn't experience a literal rapture and then entered heaven. This scenario implies the failure of every promise listed above, meaning in the text that is not included here in the book. So what they're saying, on the one hand, you have to give them credit for the idea that they want to see Jesus' words fulfilled in a very concrete, literal way. So we can grant them that. That's admirable, particularly, I think, in contrast to partial preterism. So they are at least willing to do that. However, it's not realistic. It misinterprets Matthew 24, and it doesn't match up with the rest of history. Or it basically, if the rapture occurred then, what essentially happens, and I was just reading this on the internet just a few minutes ago, actually. This was a partial preterist talking about full preterism, but he was saying, and I can see why, that basically if there was a literal rapture in 70 AD, then God has basically left the world to Satan to do with as he wants, with no end in sight. It can go on for eternity. People just keep being born into the kingdom of Satan, and this could just go on for a long, long time because Jesus has already come. It certainly does harm to the matter of, well, are we still in the church, or did part of the church get raptured, or is the church no longer in existence? And I actually did some searches trying to find the answer to that question. I haven't found that answer. If anybody knows what the full preterist says about the church today, please let me know. I'm going to continue to search for that. They say, if there wasn't a literal rapture, the living Christians did not actually see Christ, their bodies were not transformed, and then gets a little sarcastic, they were absent from their own wedding. The bridegroom returned but failed to pick up his bride. Let's see here. Now, looking at, on the next page, we have a quote, or not on the next page, it may be the same page for you. Is he continuing there? Yeah, I think he's continuing. So he continues to write, futurist author Charles Hill calls the first century rapture belief bizarre. So he's, and then he goes on to say that at the middle of that paragraph, of course it is bizarre. So they admit that it is bizarre, the Bible, but he says the Bible is filled with bizarre events. And the truth is, I can't argue with him on that either. Creation of Adam from dirt, parting of the Red Sea, Elisha's floating axe head. You have to admit that one's kind of bizarre, without being sacrilegious. And Christ's resurrection, I don't know that I would put that in the bizarre category or the rapture, but I understand what he's saying. And then he writes, some have protested, but there's no proof a rapture took place. And then he says, well, that depends on what one considers proof. And then again, he goes to saying, if the Bible said it, it must have happened. Whether, no matter how bizarre it may seem, it must have happened. It must have happened. Now look down to the next highlighted section. Christ returned out of literal crowds and clouds, and the living Christians with glorified bodies rose into the air to meet him and the previously resurrected saints. Then they all proceeded to heaven for the wedding feast. So the church, or at least those people at that time who were part of the church, have already experienced the wedding supper of the Lamb. So again, it begs the question, does that mean that we don't get to participate in the wedding supper of the Lamb? And do we or do we not stand before the judgment seat of Christ? So it even though they try to maintain the integrity of Matthew 24, they just do irreparable harm to so many other passages that require even more difficult interpretations of other passages than it would be just to rethink Matthew 24 a little bit. Objection. Why is there nothing in the historical record regarding people disappearing? Surely someone would have written about this, and I think I referred to this the other day. He says there are at least three reasons. Although the church had spread across the Roman Empire, the first three chapters of Revelation indicate Jesus was not pleased with a significant number of his people. So not only is it partial or full preterism in that the rapture literally occurred, but not everyone in the church was raptured. So you have the church spread out across the Roman Empire by 70 AD through the ministry of the apostles and their disciples, but a lot of the churches, for example, the majority of the churches in Asia Minor were corrupted and not living for the Lord, so they missed out. They were not raptured. I'm not sure how that explains there being no record, because if you're left behind, I would think that you would be pretty upset about that one. I know if it happens to me, I'm going to be pretty upset. And I'm not anticipating that, folks. That was not... and then he says, the warnings contained in these chapters indicate the number of people raptured may have been smaller than we might have thought. Many who assumed they were good Christians on solid ground were likely unaware they had totally missed the event. Now, I don't know, and it's sometimes it is hard to keep from crossing the line into being facetious. But the very real question is, what happened to your friends and neighbors? I mean, it wasn't even in the time of rapid transportation. I mean, people just don't take off and disappear. This just popped into my head. What happened to all the children? Were the children all left behind? It's very difficult to build a theology very concretely about children, but there are passages in the Bible that seem to speak to that issue. So were the children left, or were they taken? And if they were taken, or were children left parentless? Were children orphaned? So, I mean, there, and obviously we're going to have that question to deal with. I mean, we won't, but somebody's going to have to deal with that question, even concerning our rapture. I don't know if you've thought about that or not. Not necessarily children being orphaned, but there are going to be some really significant issues related to that. But anyway, another thing he says, and I don't have it listed here, I guess, is that another reason it's not recorded is that there was nobody to record it. I mean, if you participated in it, obviously you weren't there to write about it. So he gives us several reasons. But we'll get to Matthew 24. Now, partial preterism, he says, we may distinguish between two distinct forms of preterism, which I call radical preterism and moderate preterism. And then he explains that. And so the purpose of this book, Sproul's book, The Last Days According to Jesus, and as you can see, I don't know if you've noticed, but my footnotes, except for just a couple, they're all referencing digital format, Kindle or Logos. my digital library increased significantly in preparing for this course. My wife hasn't seen the bill yet. So. I'm just kidding. She anticipates it, whether I tell her or not. Partial preterism support. Okay, the time references. So there are several things that are said to support the partial preterism view. And the essential, I mean, if you're looking at one specific thing, we're looking at the time frame references. That is really the issue. That is the supporting issue for partial preterism. So Sproul, quoting Russell in his book, he says, "The plain grammatical meaning of these statements has been fully discussed in these pages," meaning Matthew, I think in specifically Matthew 24 on this one. "No violence can extort from them any other sense than the obvious, unambiguous one, vis-a-vis that our Lord's second coming would take place within the limits of the existing generation." So again, going back to this generation. And there are, there are several passages, a few passages in Matthew that are pointed to, that they point to concerning this. I need to step back and get my Bible because I didn't bring it up here. It's probably in my case. So Matthew 10:23. Thank you. Matthew 10:23. "When they persecute you in this city, flee to another, for assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes." The question is, and the crux issue here then is, when he says the Son of Man comes, is he talking about the parousia, the second coming? Is that what he's talking about? And so I have. So what we're going to do is we're going to move to the next text because I think it's the same idea. He's referring to the same coming. I don't think it's the second coming, but he's talking about the same revelation of himself. Matthew 16:28, and this is probably the one that you're more familiar with. Matthew 16:28. "Assuredly, I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom." So, two things are going to happen. One, on your ministry, on your mission journey, on your ministry travels throughout Israel, you're not going to make it to all the cities before you see the Son of Man coming. And He also says, and you're not going to die before you see the Son of Man coming. Have you noticed the context and what Matthew did and put together concerning His coming? Look at chapter 17, verse 1. "And now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, His brother, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and He was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and His clothes became as white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with Him. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here." And Jimmy talked about this earlier. "And while He was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice came out of the cloud, saying, This is My beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear Him." This is a glimpse into what the coming Messiah is going to be like when He takes when He does return to take over His throne. It's a foretaste for the disciples of just what it is they're proclaiming. They are proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. Israel, be ready to receive your king, and then Jesus unveils His glory. He unveils His glory that He has hidden from them as He has taken on humanity. He humbled himself, and now the three of them, along with two prophets, the lawgiver and Elijah the great prophet, the one who would come before the great and terrible day of the Lord, and Jesus opens up the veil and lets them see his glory, a taste of what the kingdom is going to be like. Can you imagine if they were preaching with conviction before this? What was it like when they made it to the rest of the cities in Israel? And they saw this before they got through all the cities, and they saw this before they died. They saw the Son of Man. And when you get to Matthew 24, we see a similar picture of the coming of the Son of Man, a similar description that when every eye will see it. So he's given a glimpse to the three men who are in his inner circle, James, Peter, and John. You know, you have the 70 and other disciples out on the fringes, and then you have the 70 that he sent out, and then you have the 12, then you have the three, then you have one, John, the one whom Jesus loved. So you have this, and Jesus showed himself to the three. This is what you men are proclaiming. Can you imagine? It had to transform. Not only was he transformed, but they were transformed in their ministry. We can imagine that. So the point being this: when we say that there's another way to understand this generation, when we say there's another way to understand not having made it through all the cities of Israel, when we say there's another way of understanding what it means when he says the Son, you will see the Son coming in his kingdom before you die, we can see that Matthew has put this together in such a way that we're not doing any gymnastics at all to say, well, it's not talking about the second coming of Jesus and his glory. It's talking about a revelation of what the kingdom's going to be like when he does come. We're not playing with the text, and we are being as literal and true to the text as the full preterists want to be. And again, I honor them for that desire. But you have to deal with a whole lot of other texts. And now we'll move to Matthew 24:34. Matthew 24. Now, Matthew 24, as Jimmy has said as well, is the Olivet Discourse. The discourse on the Mount of Olives, discussing Daniel's 70th week. Now, Matthew 24:34. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till these things take place. So, looking at the significance of the significance for the preterist position, as I mentioned before, this is the key passage combined with the previous two we just looked at. Now, based upon what we've just seen, we understand that, or we have at least a hint that we are not forced to, and that's what the partial or the full preterist and even the partial preterist would say, we're forced to see the second coming in some way or completely by 70 AD. And the usage of this generation is said that makes that conclusion inescapable. That's the significance of this passage. And you have parallel passages. I have key verses here, Matthew 24:34, Mark 13:30, and Luke 21:32. Now look at the context again. Actually, go back to the beginning of the Olivet Discourse. What was it? What was the situation that led to the Olivet Discourse? It goes back to the disciples' question in Matthew 24, verse 3. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? When will they happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So they're think about this. Remember, back in 16, they've gotten the glimpse. So now they're saying, okay, now we're preaching the kingdom because we've got a glimpse, and man, we're going through the rest of the towns of Israel, and we're going to do this before we die. So when is it actually coming? When is it actually going to happen? When are we going to see it? When's going to be the fulfillment of this? So that's the context. And Jesus begins his discourse. And Jesus answered and said, take heed that no one deceives you. Well, that's an important way to start a message, isn't it? And what do we have going on today? There is a lot of deception. And I have to say it appears like apparent deception. Intentional deception. For the most, I'm not going to say that, but I'm going to say that there are significant problems, and you don't have to be an intentional false teacher to be a false teacher. You can be sincerely wrong. I mean, you know, people say, well, how can that be? If you're really sincere, doesn't that lead you into all truth? And what's happened is that people have exchanged objective truth for sincerity, and they've exchanged faith for sincerity. If you're sincere, that's equivalent to faith. No, you can be sincerely wrong. Look at a billion Muslims and look at a billion Hindus. See, and the truth is, folks, there are people in our camp that we sometimes do the same thing or a similar thing in that we say, for example, the mega churches. We'll look at the mega churches, and I have nothing against a mega church necessarily, but my point is this. We look at these kinds of numbers and see them as a validation and a stamp of approval that this must be the right message because so many believe it. If you read articles, just Christianity Today, yesterday's internet version, Christianity Today Direct, talking about the charismatic movement and talking about what has happened. If you read a lot of what would have been conservative evangelical writers, they will say, and you'll see this more and more frequently, that if you could point to one thing that has happened in the church in the last 100 years that has been the most important and the most significant and therefore the most positive, it is the work of the Pentecostals and the Charismatics to bring a vital Christianity and a renewal to Christianity worldwide, and it's brought people back in touch with a spiritual life that the church had lost. And you will see over and over again the charismatic movement, even for people who don't personally hold to the sign gifts or at least practice them themselves, they hold up what the charismatic and Pentecostal preachers have done through their proclamation of the spiritual gifts and by default. You're giving that those things must be really from God. I mean, you're giving that. If it's a good thing, it has to be from God. Because if it's not from God, then no matter what happens, it's not a good thing because it's deception. See what I'm saying? You know, I don't want, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to be so narrow that I'm against everybody, or at least it comes across like I'm against everybody. And that's what we get accused of. It's not that I'm against them, it's what I'm for. It's not what I'm against, it's what I'm for. and I'm for handling the Word of God correctly. And that's what we need to be for. Like I said yesterday, we don't have to go out looking for battles. They're going to find us. All right? So, we know that Satan, in his war against God, he's out to win the war, not necessarily individual battles. He goes out, he's got the long view. And he, you know, a good general, as hard as it might be, he may give up a hill to gain three. Right? He may give up a few good men to save the platoon. That's just simple strategy. So we've got a long view here. And if, think about this, if it is true that the charismatic church is providing false signs and wonders to lay the foundation to prepare people to accept anything miraculous as from God, that, and that's what is thought. If it's miraculous, it must be from God. That's the logic. Then what does that do for the Antichrist when he and the false prophet perform signs and wonders? And remember this, signs and wonders are to convince people of the truth of the message. And we read in 2 Thessalonians that the purpose of the false signs and wonders are to get people to accept what kind of message? A false message. So Jesus says, that rabbit trail was for free. So Jesus says, take heed that no one deceives you. And then he goes on to say, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. But there's other kinds of deceptions going on. And we know that when we get to 1 and 2 Thessalonians, another deception that was going on was people saying that the rapture had already occurred. And that was less than 20 years before the full and partial preterists are saying, or at least the full preterists are saying the rapture occurred when it really didn't. So that deception that was going on and the problem that the Thessalonians were facing would just propagate it, and now it's been carried on for 2,000 years. At least it's been revived in the full preterism and to some degree in partial preterism. So another thing that we look at here then is all these things in... All right, on to verse 34 again, back to verse 34. Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Now what we're going to do is, we're going to just, because of what we said so much already in different places, we're going to jump ahead in your notes to my response or our response to the all these things. So we'll just go ahead and do that. We don't need to, you can read in your notes what has been said, and I would encourage you in some ways to look up some of the books where these come from. Okay, all these things, this is 1b, Matthew 24, 6 to 29. Jesus is referring back to all these things. What are these things? All right, take a look in verse 6, starting in verse 6. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. That is key to the rest of what he's saying, because he says that see that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. What is his point? His point is, he is not returning. He is not going to step foot on the Mount of Olives until these things have come to pass. And so you know it's not going to happen until these things come to pass. Well, what things are they that are going to pass? Okay, wars and rumors of wars, verse 6. Verse 7, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Verse 7 again, famines, pestilences, earthquakes. Verse 9, Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Verse 10, and then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So all of this has to happen, or he's not going to be back to set up his kingdom. So for those who would say that that Jesus returned either spiritually or literally in 70 AD, yes, there is a setting the stage for the final fulfillment of these, but one, has the gospel of the kingdom been preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations? People, you know, the argument is, well, the known world, the Roman world. Well, but that's not what it says. And I understand the thinking. There were people in the Roman world who didn't know there was any other world. But God did. Jesus did. He knew it was more than just the known Roman world. And you think about the Apostle Thomas went to India. Most of the people in the Roman Empire weren't even aware that there were people that far away. And they took the gospel to India. You can go to India today, and especially in the north, and they talk about the church in India going clear back to the Apostle Thomas. So, going on. Then you have in verse 15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, that is a key marker. Why is that a key marker? Because we know that that's the midpoint of the tribulation. That means that you back up 3.5 years and you have time for these other things to happen. Now we've come to the midpoint of the tribulation. So we know that Jesus, this is where we know that Jesus is talking about Daniel's 70th week. Because he speaks of the abomination of desolation, we know, okay, this is what he's talking about. So we've gotten to this point. Okay, now what about after the abomination of desolation? Well, you have a series of sign events. You have the first series of sign events, and not necessarily tied directly one-to-one to those in Revelation, but there is a correspondence. Then you have the second series of sign events, intense persecution of the Jews in 16 to 20. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down. Verse 21, for then there will be great tribulation such as not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So now he is taking us to the point where we're past the abomination of desolation. We're at a point where the judgments are going to intensify. These things have happened up till now are judgments. Now the judgments are going to intensify. You ever see that anywhere else? The book of Revelation. You're going along, and then the judgments intensify dramatically. And what do those signs look like in the book of Revelation? Well, look at what he says and see if there's a correlation. Verse 23, then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. What is the Antichrist going to want people to believe? That he is the Christ. All right? For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. The Antichrist and the false prophet do what? Signs and wonders. All right? Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out, or look, he is in the inner room, do not believe it. Now, look at this. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. There are judgments coming, and people are going to be dead, and they're going to be more and more dying as you approach the actual return of Christ to the earth. Now, look at verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Remember seeing that anywhere else? All right. If we're going to do any justice to the text, to any degree, what happened in 70 AD that can be legitimately said to even approach these signs? There's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. And I was thinking when Jimmy was going through all these detailed, as he's been going through all these detailed things, if those things that Jimmy's been talking about, I mean just verse after verse and going through Ezekiel and the details of the temple, And the details of the of Israel being in the land, and this promise and this promise. It's not just the big promises. There are little promises all along the way concerning how it's going to work its way out. If those things are fulfilled spiritually in the church, would you explain to me why the prophets of God wasted their time on absolutely ridiculous level of detail? That this line would be drawn here and this boundary would be set here. There is no way to correlate 99% of those details with any spiritual fulfillment. It's what's that do to the Bible? It makes it that the majority of the Old Testament can just be completely ignored. And what's being done today in the churches? It's being ignored. And you know the charts we were looking at this morning about how you step back and you look at the big picture and you can see the sweep of the covenants and how that works out all the way to the millennium. What I found teaching theology and just teaching the Bible to the students in the Bible Institute in Hungary, we set up our Bible survey to teach Bible survey diachronically. We taught it chronologically rather than Bible book order. And what that did was it helped the students to develop their theology in the context of Revelation. And you know what happened? By having the students develop their theology from Genesis to Malachi and then into the Gospels and then into Acts and seeing, for example, the purpose of signs and wonders. Why were there signs and wonders? God's faithfulness to His promises. What does it mean to be entered into an unconditional covenant? And you know what happened? Our students came from all over the world, from every conceivable church, every conceivable background. Most of them were untaught, so they weren't necessarily locked in. In 15 years of teaching the Bible, I never got into a theological argument in the classroom about somebody disputing one of the hot topics in the New Testament. If you start in the New Testament and you start on a hot topic, you're going to have problems. But if you start and you develop it, the hot topics are no longer hot topics. Eternal security is not an issue because we know God is faithful to unconditional covenants and we're in one of those. We're experiencing the blessings of one of those. We understand that signs are a sign of judgment and a wicked, perverse generation seeks after signs. And you go through, most of history was not defined by signs and wonders. But when you started seeing signs and wonders, did the people of Israel say, "Praise God, we're doing it right. This is God's blessing." No. When they saw signs and wonders, they thought, "Uh-oh, we're in trouble." You ever notice that? It turns what is being taught today completely on its head if you understand the purpose of these things. The Bible deals with the hot topics itself. if people know the Bible. So you have this happening. Now you have the second coming, verse 30. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather his elect from the four winds and from one end of heaven to another. Now, verse 32 through 35. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. You also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the door. What if you haven't seen the things yet? You're not there yet. Have we seen these things? No. Has the second coming happened? No. So we come to verse 34. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. You see the theme that Jesus has developed from the beginning of the sermon, from the Olivet Discourse? The way this is often translated, and sometimes, or not translated, but interpreted and understood, even sometimes by dispensationalists, is that when Jesus says this generation, he's putting a time marker on the beginning of the sign. That's not true. He's putting a marker for the end of the generation. In other words, you haven't reached the end of the generation until all these signs have happened. It's not that the signs are going to start before the end of the generation. Yes, that has to happen, but the focus is on the end of the generation and what you will know. And he's saying, don't think that the second coming, don't think that the Son of Man has returned until you see these signs. And when you see these signs, you know you're approaching the end of this age in God's program. It's not the generation of those who are alive. And the context is Daniel's 70th week. Jesus is preaching on Daniel's 70th week. This is an age, a time period in God's program. This age in God's program, this generation will not be over until Jesus comes, and you know that he hasn't come yet, and he's not going to come until these signs have happened and you see them. All right? It's not a marker for the beginning of the signs. It's a marker for the end of the age. Okay? Let's have a word of prayer.